Let me pray before we get started. Dear Lord, I thank you for today. I thank you just for another day that we could come to your church this morning and learn from your word about this topic that just is so personal to so many of us and something that we all struggle with. And I just ask you to just take this time. Just you speak through me. Just get me out of the way and any thoughts I have or agendas or opinions, just move that out of the way and just let this be your truth and your words for this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. Welcome, everybody. I am so excited to teach today for a couple reasons. First, my mom is here, which is so fun. She's never heard me talk. Hey. that's so fun for me. And secondly, I just love this subject. I probably could talk for 3 hours, but we will not, I promise. But I did have to really cut, and I will talk really fast because there's just a lot I want to get through. But I love this lesson for a couple reasons. First of all, it's probably what you thought when we said we're teaching this semester on coveting. This is probably where your mind went, of coveting and money and possession. So it's just so real to a lot of us and just something that as humans we struggle with. So, but also I love this lesson because I love money and I love, I'm going to explain that. And I love God. And this kind of merges the two. Let me explain what I mean when I say I love money. Every once in a while, you'll have, little kids that, you'll have some 10-year-old that's like, I want to be a doctor. And they grow up to be a doctor. Or you'll have some little girl that loves kittens and, well, I want to be a vet. And she really grows up to be a vet. I can picture middle school, saw the silliest, cheesiest 80s movie with Helen Slater and Michael J. Fox, Secret to My Success. You probably, no one's ever seen it in this room, probably. Have you? Or you have? Yeah. I was that kid in middle school. I mean, you can't make this stuff up, I promise. Saw that movie, saw Helen Slater. I was like, I want to be her. I want a suit, and I want a briefcase, and I want to work in a big building with money. I'm not lying. And that was me. I mean, I remember this years later, and I Googled the year that movie came out, and I was almost embarrassed at how young I was when I decided I wanted a briefcase and I wanted to wear a suit. I can still remember going to Josue Banks when they carried women's things, and my mom bought me that first suit. I mean, I just always wanted to do that. It's what I did. I started working for a bank right out of high school. I worked for 15 years. I was in the financial world. I was a financial planner, had all my investment licenses. I just have always been fascinated with numbers and money, and so not, I don't mean I love money greedily, but just it fascinated me, and I wanted to work with money and help people with money, and how do you look at it, and how do you talk about it? So I do love money and I love numbers, so I could talk about it all day. The other thing that really turned me on to this subject was when Alan and I were newlyweds, we did a class in Memphis at Second Pres that changed our lives. And I don't know if any of you have ever done Crown Ministries. Anybody? I'm going to sign you up. Oh, good. So, and there are other classes similar to this, but we did this course when we were newlyweds. I remember it was pretty intensive. We had to sign a contract. We would be there every week, and there was major homework and commitments and memorization. Changed our lives because there's so much to learn about God and how he feels about money and how he talks about it and how he instructs us on money. It's funny, I literally had to pull this book out from under my couch where it was so covered in dust. That's probably why I started sneezing and couldn't wear my contacts today. But I had forgotten how much I loved this textbook until I pulled it out and started working on this lesson. So I will give you the tip. It is on Amazon for $4.50. So you should all write that down. It looks like this. Well, the picture they have looks like the one from under my couch. It looks like it was from the Bible times. But literally, this red workbook is on Amazon for $4.50. It is the best money you will ever spend, even if you can't do the course with a group.
What's it called?
Crown Ministries. It's the workbook. And they put out lots of materials, and I think they still go around the country and do courses, but it's just all about money. There are so many verses in here and how to look at it from stewardship and giving and your job. And anyway, just when we did this, light bulbs went off as to, wow, I mean, God has real strong opinions about money, and there's a lot to learn about money and how to view it correctly. It was in that class, I think light bulbs really went off of like, yeah, it's not mine. If that light bulb has not gone off for you, hopefully it will before the end of the day. It's not ours. And God has a lot to say. I first heard these numbers when I did that class, and I heard them recently, too. Also, I think I mentioned I heard Dave Ramsey, who's like the financial Christian guru, twice in January at a conference. So I'm a little wound up, too. And he quoted these same things. In the Bible, there are 500 verses on prayer, about 500 that talk about faith. Do you know how many verses are in the Bible that talk about money and financial things? You ready for this? 2,300. That was a good response. Brinkley gets a star. 15% of everything that Jesus talked about while he walked on this earth, those 30 years, money and finances. Almost all of the parables deal with money and finances. That should get our attention big time. I mean, there are more verses in here on money and finances than so many other topics. And I think that's for a few reasons. First of all, God knows us and he knows our hearts and he knows what a quick stumbling block that is. He knows that we are people that are going to build shiny golden calves and worship them. I mean, money is shiny and it is alluring and it is attractive and the things we can buy with it are fun and make us feel good, and they quickly become gods. And so I think God knew and Jesus knew I need to give them some instructions because it's just so quickly a god. And I think the way we deal with money affects our fellowship with God and Jesus, and it's just such a dangerous, slippery slope. So there's a lot in here on money. I will not read all 2,300 verses. Very tempting. But if you get that red workbook, you probably have half of them. So why is it dangerous? Like I said, it's just so visible, and it's so shiny, and it's so tempting, and we just are so easily drawn to it because it makes us feel powerful. It makes us feel important. It gives us a sense of security, a false sense of security. Anyway, a lot to say. Flip with me to Mark 10. Like I said, I'm going to go fast, but and I have a lot of verses written down. I will do like a cheat sheet for next week with all these verses and have it on the table, so I forgot to do that because there were too many to write on the board. Mark 10:23. And Jesus looked around and said to his disciples, "How difficult will it be for those who have wealth to enter the kingdom of God?" And the disciples were amazed at his words. But Jesus said to them, "Children, how difficult is it to enter the kingdom of God? It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God." Don't you remember learning that verse as a kid? I mean, that just stuck in my head. Again, I was probably the money nerd. That was like, what? but, I mean, that verse is just so key. And I'll say this repeatedly, it is not wrong to have wealth. Every person in this room, because we live in America, we are in the super wealthy of the world. But it is not wrong to have wealth. That is not a bad thing. And it does not mean that you cannot go to heaven. It just means that it's a danger zone. And so it's difficult to handle that well. And Jesus is not opposed to wealth at all. He blesses his people richly. It's the love of wealth. That's where you cross the line. 1 Timothy 6:10 says, "For the love of money is the root of all evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many grief." So again, it's that pursuit of money that can pull you away from the faith. So what is greed? We talked in the beginning, there's three kinds of coveting, and greed is one of those that deals with money and possession specifically. The basic definition, it's intense and selfish desire for something, especially food, wealth, or power, voracity, insatiability, were other things that came up. And those obviously don't sound very positive, right? I mean, you just don't use that in a positive light. And the sad thing about greed, when you think about it, and it's like I talked about coveting, it accomplishes nothing. It really is not going to get you any more of what you're desiring. And it never satisfies. If you think about it, greed is something that that people struggle with, whether their income is $10,000 a year or their income is $1 million a year. It does not discriminate with levels of income. I think maybe people on this poorer side of that spectrum think, well, if I can just get to X, I won't deal with greed anymore. Right? I mean, do we all maybe struggle with that or think, okay, I know, but if my husband just gets, if he can make this much money, then I will not deal with greed anymore. Or just if I can get to this house, I'll be cured of this sin of coveting. It's never enough. I mean, it's just, you look at people in the Bible, people in history that just cannot acquire enough. The more you get, then you get used to that level, and then you think, I just need a little more. And then you get used to that, and you think, I need a little more. It's never going to satisfy us. And at the heart of that greedy person is a belief that the money is the provider, and it's going to produce the joy, not God, who's really the provider. God warns us about this over and over because it's a slippery slope that can take our focus away from him. I'm going to flip to 1 Corinthians 1 Corinthians 6, 9. Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor men who practice homosexuality, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. So that is in a pretty dark list, which might make you feel, ugh. But then read verse 11. And such were some of you, but you were washed, you were sanctified, and you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. So don't get discouraged today that, oh, my greedy heart, there's nothing I can do about it. There is. We can be washed of that greed and that sin. So one of the key characters in the Bible that we look at that was so greedy, and it's not someone that I typically thought of as greedy in the past until the author of this book pulled it out, but it's Judas, who we know is the betrayer. But we fail sometimes to think about why he did it. And looking, I don't know if you know that he was the sort of the keeper of the money bag, and he was tempted often and liked to sort of skim some off the top. In the New Testament, when we see the story of when they broke the perfume and poured it out to wash Jesus' feet, he was the one that spoke up so quickly and was like, "Why did you do that? That was a year's worth of income." There was greed there that was brewing. Not long after that story was when he went straight out to the chief priest to say, "How much will you give me to turn him over?" That was greed that was driving his actions. He wrongly assumed that he could worship Jesus and money. And he just could not ever let go of his love of money. And for 30 pieces of silver, that was all it took for him to turn over Jesus. And don't forget, he had been there. I mean, this was not like, oh, there's a guy, Jesus, yeah, I'll show you where he lives. He was one of the disciples. He saw him walk on water with his own eyes. He saw him feed the 5,000. He saw him heal the blind. But yet for 30 pieces of silver, he was willing to turn away from that. He loved that money, that pursuit of money so much that he really failed to fully believe in Jesus. And he wasn't able to enjoy it. I mean, we see what happened. He ended up taking his own life. It was a terrible story. And it's never going to fill what Jesus could have given him, the grace and the mercy and the forgiveness. there's a great quote in the book. It said, "A love of money exposes a lack of love for Christ. If you desire to be rich, be warned. Money is not an easy master." I love that quote, don't you? I mean, money is not an easy master. That is so true. We talked last week about what a great master God can be and wanting to take our burdens and help us rest. Money never does that. Money is not an easy master and may one day fill your life with grief. If you want to find life, hear the word of Jesus. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. So, now that I've depressed you about this big, ugly, dark sin called greed, we have to sort of look at our pattern. And I won't do this every week, but this week it was just, you know, you've seen, or if some of you haven't been here before, these are the pattern of coveting, the things we tend to do. And then we'll look at what we're trying to replace them with, the new pattern, once we shift our hearts. So first we see, sorry, y'all. This one, I do have a page of notes. However, I probably didn't need to say a word because we just know, don't we? If we covet, it's because we see something. It's so easy in this area to just see something. I mean, in our society today, we are bombarded with images in front of us. It is unavoidable. I mean, if you have any sort of technology or walk around, drive around, the store windows, the internet, the Facebook, the social media, the ads that'll just pop up on your phone, you know, we are bombarded with visual images of, ooh, maybe I want that. It's hard to avoid. I think I love Facebook, and I'm on there. I've said that before, but it is such a great tool for Satan to stir this up, is it not? You know, you just see outfits, or you see clothes, or you see, oh, he got a new job, or oh, this or that. We just see things, and even if we are sort of strong at first, we're just worn down by the repetition of seeing things over and over. We're equally, sadly, I think influenced by just what our friends have around us. And it just sort of wears us down over time. I think I mentioned that when I was buying a new minivan, I had a friend that just kind of planted that seed of like, well, if I got to drive a big old boxy, nerdy minivan, I want a nice minivan. You just get worn down by those. Or, you know, you just see enough people having things that you want, even though you don't really need them and don't have the funds for that. And you just, it can wear us down. But we need to realize, and again, this will be true for every week in the next few weeks, don't trust your eyes. Realize that you're seeing what you want to see. You know, you might be seeing that friend that, got that new minivan, but we don't know what else is going on in her life and her heart or in God's provisions to her. We see what we want to see, don't we? I mean, I mentioned last week, if you're, you know, struggling with clothes or something, every cute outfit's going to pass you by. You know, Satan knows how to tempt you and make you think, yeah, you need that to fit in. You just need to know that you're not seeing the full picture and you're not seeing what God is doing in that life. We also have to know our weaknesses. We have to know how to shield our eyes and learn. Like, I mean, I've talked to friends that Facebook, they just can't handle it. They struggle with the images they see or the feelings it stirs up, so they've just gotten off of it. Or if you have a real problem shopping when you know you don't need to, don't window shop or just don't go. You know, just don't put yourself in that situation. I personally learned I don't love magazines. Now I have a mother who loves magazines. I finally had to tell her, I don't like magazines. And it's funny, and my sister too, and my friends can look at magazines and love it and get ideas, and it's so fun and share. I would find myself sometimes sitting in my house, which I love, and that's beautiful, but then you sit there and look. It was a trigger for me. I would, you know, love everything, and then I would open a magazine and think, oh, yeah, mine's pretty dated, or, you know, yeah, that's the newest fabric, or that is, I mean, it would just sort of spark things in me, and I was like, this is not relaxing to me. I'm not bashing magazines. I mean, some of you might sit there and love it. For me, it was a trigger. It stirred up negative feelings. So I was like, why do I need to do that to myself? So I don't get magazines anymore. But just know your triggers. If there's something where you know you see things and it stirs up these feelings, well, protect your eyes and protect your heart and avoid some of those things. So after we see, then the next step is we covet. And there's such a fine line between desiring something rightly and when it crosses that line to coveting. Like we've said, and I'll repeat every week, it is not wrong to have a desire. It is not wrong to maybe wish you could redo your den or have a bigger house. It is not wrong to desire more income. It's just when that consumes you or turns you to bitterness or doubting God's provision or anger or frustration or jealousy that you cross that line to coveting. there are just some sort of checkpoints on to question, am I coveting or am I just wishing I had something else? You know, if you constantly compare yourselves to others, you know, you may be coveting. If you spend a lot of time thinking about what other people make and how much did that cost, or I wonder what she spent on that, or sort of throwing stones of like, well, she shouldn't have bought that. I know they don't make that much money, or oh, I bet she's got credit card debt. You know, if you constantly do that, you've probably crossed the line to coveting. You know, a greedy person will judge another for monetary purchases while always excusing hers. And I struggle with this because I am a money person. I'm a budget person. I'm a numbers. And so, you know, I'll pat myself on the back that we're so good at this, Larry, and we don't spend what they do. But then I'll blow it on something else. I mean, we all have our desires and our areas where we want to spend. But it's when we judge and question and get consumed with it, you know, and if you're judging others based on their income or putting expectations onto them based on what they make or what you think they make or what you think they should make, or then that's kind of a red light that you might be coveting. The book talked about this, and I thought it was so wise. And if you think about it, so a greedy woman both loves and hates other women with money. And that's so true. We sort of love them. We're drawn to them, and we want to hang out with them, and we want to vacation with them, and we want to dress like them and be like them. But then we kind of hate them too. If you get there, you find yourself so jealous you can't enjoy it, or you're throwing stones, or you're questioning their purchases. It's just a fine line, and it's just a danger area. frequent complaining and grumbling. definitely could mean, you know, okay, red flag, I'm starting to covet. If money causes frequent fights between you and your spouse, greed might be at the root, and that's something that is just, I wish I had statistics, but I know it's one of the top reasons for divorce. It's just, it's an area that, because you've got strong opinions and strong feelings, that can really cause conflict in a marriage. Also consider how you work when being paid versus when you are just serving. You know, do you have that same enthusiasm and drive and strength in your work when you're not getting paid? You know, that Christ should be our motivating factor in all that we do. And the money is just a good provision. It shouldn't be what drives us. We shouldn't pick our activities or how to spend our time just because I'm going to get paid for this one, not for this one, not for this one. But really, we probably know our hearts pretty quickly. You can just sort of feel it. I mean, we know when it crosses that line or when it feels yuck, okay, I'm probably coveting. I mean, we can recognize it pretty quickly, sadly. So next, we take. And a lot of you might think, well, no, we don't steal. I mean, we probably do not covet our friend's sweater and then sneak in their house and take it when we're over for dinner. If you do, come see me after. But we do take. It leads us to take away from other people. because we feel entitled sometimes and we think, I deserve that and I should get that or get a piece of that. But most often our greed makes us take from others when we fail to give to others because we just think, I gotta have it. And in case you're thinking, oh, this is not a talk where she talks about giving, sorry, it's coming. But we do, we take from other people when we fail to give because we want for ourselves so much. Husbands, or and not just husbands, that's sexist, but people would take time and love and availability from families as they pursue money. You know, if that becomes your focus, then you're blinded to the other needs around you of your family. Women, we can take from our families in order to sustain a certain type of lifestyle. If, you know, we're determined we got to have this kind of lifestyle when really God has provided this kind, we're taking joy and fulfillment from our families. And we can take from a friend by coveting what she has. Like I said, if it starts with that jealousy and resentment, you're failing to be the best friend to her that you can because you will probably withhold compliments, withhold joy on her, whatever she just got. You're taking from her. And this one strikes me, too, because I think it's so key. We can absolutely take from our children and take some of their innocence and take some of their purity when we pass this on to them. I think it's something that we do so subconsciously sometimes, but we have to be aware. I mean, they watch us, and they learn from us whether we are saying it or not, but we are teaching them money habits. We are teaching them, you know, if anytime someone passes you, you make a negative comment about, oh, well, they can't afford that, or you don't think that six-year-old's hearing that? I mean, they hear us, or they hear your grumbling about what God has provided. I think we just need to be so careful to not pass this on to our kids. They will get enough of this on their own because they are sinners and they have a sinful heart. And they will learn this on their own. But we don't want to take that from them before we need to. You know, teach them these principles now. That red book I showed you for $4.50, it has illustrations. So you could teach your children those concepts. Proverbs 22:6 says, train a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Can't stress that enough. It's so key to teach our kids these concepts. And lastly, we hide and we have consequences. Ralph Waldo Emerson once wrote, money often costs too much. And that's so true. That pursuit of money costs us too much. We will have consequences. And it will never lead to satisfaction. As Solomon warned in Ecclesiastes, whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. And for a family, the love of money will lead to misplaced priorities, strife in marriage, undue stress, discontented children. Our communities and local missionaries and the poor will also suffer consequences from our greed. You know, like we read, it can lead you from the faith. It can just turn your focus so much from Christ that it just puts you in a negative place outside of his blessing. So, as with every single aspect of our lives, this area has to be redeemed. This whole area of money, which Jesus knew was such a part of our lives because it's how we function in society. I mean, we have to have money, and that's. But he knew it was such a huge area. But it has to be redeemed. We cannot do this on our own. Like we said last week, the cross is the only answer, and letting Jesus redeem this situation and redeem our hearts. We all come into this financial subject with baggage, or not necessarily baggage, but just our own perceptions or our thoughts or our ideas or how our parents raised us or things that they said or did. Or we either grew up with so much money we were spoiled, or we grew up with no money and we were so poor, so now we were trying to get. And there's just lots that plays into sort of your financial personality that has to be put at the cross, because we just have to try to balance this well. So we're going to try to break this pattern of sin and coveting in this area. So we have to switch to our new pattern. So instead of seeing everything around us and desiring that, we want to seek the Lord. And we're going to go to that every week again. It just has to start there. We have to seek Him first. And two main truths that lead us to that. Number one, God is the provider. 1 Timothy 6:17 says, "As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, not to set their hopes in the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life." Our hope provision should be focused on Him, not on what He provides, and not on our own good works. A person who believes God as the provider prays and seeks counsel regarding purchases. She is thoughtful and wise with her money because she views it as entrusted to her by the Lord rather than earned by her work. Again, it's just focus on Him as the provider. If you give your child a great gift for a birthday or Christmas, I mean, you want them to love it, but you want some of that love and appreciation to come back to you, right? I mean, you don't want them just, "Oh, I got this, what a jelly bean machine. Chase just bought a jelly bean machine." But, I mean, with birthday money, but you don't want them, I mean, we get so caught up on, "Look at this thing I bought," and forget who provided. And again, focus on the provider makes you realize, "Oh, okay, yes, I've been given something. I need to be thoughtful with it and prayerful about how I spend every bit of that money." She's also thankful because her prayerful heart gives her eyes to see what has been provided rather than dwelling on what is lacking. I could not put this somewhere in here. So talking about spending wisely, this is not biblical. This is just my financial tip for the day. That was in that book in Dave Ramsey. It's so key to have a budget. And that sounds so practical and tangible. But what I mean by that is, and some of you may be like, "I'm not a money person." Too bad. To manage your money well, whether it is a little bit or a lot, you have to understand what is coming in, what is going out. That is the first key to not overspending, to not getting yourself in debt, to not becoming enslaved to money. I mean, I would argue that someone that makes $10,000 but that knows exactly, "I know I have this, I know I spend this, I know I spend this," so much better off than someone on this end of the spectrum that makes $1 million and has no clue where that money's going. There's so much power, I think, in peace and comfort and freedom from financial stress if you know where the money's going. And like I said, I'm a numbers person. I mean, and I married a numbers person. We're very scary. You give us something with some numbers, and we're going to give you a spreadsheet in 30 minutes. And we both budget each other to death. My kids even know it. We were shopping this weekend. I was with my daughter, and we bought Alan something for Valentine's Day. And she was like, "Mom, he's going to know. It's going to be on his chart." Like, he will get, I'm not lying. I mean, but I love it. We track to $10 everywhere. So literally, he probably pulled up before I could give it to him when I got home Sunday. He had seen, she bought me a pair of Valentine's socks at the Just Feet store, whatever. And my 10-year-old knew that. "Mom, it's going to be on the chart." Anyway, you may not be a numbers budget person, and that is, I say that's okay, but it's real. You need to become one a little bit. You need to have your hands around where your money's going. And I also think it's not okay for us as women to just say, "My husband does that. He's the money person. I have no idea. He just tells me how much I can spend every month." I just would caution you to maybe a couple times a year sit down and do this together and look at this together. I also, if some of you, if this is a foreign concept and you're like, "I have no idea, we are so out of control and this causes so much stress," I would love to talk to you. I used to do that a lot, and just we'll go to lunch and I'll help you kind of outline it or say, here are the questions you need to ask, or I would love to do that for you. I love it. But it needs to be a common thing in marriage, be on a common ground and not causing strife. I worked with a couple when we first moved here, that great Christian couple, friends of ours, but they were just like this over money. And she was just so angry and didn't know what was going on. And then he would just give her, here, you get X dollars a month, that's it. That was all she kind of knew about the money. And he was so angry, and he called me. He was like, please, please meet with us. And I did. He's like, I think I leave for work, and she stands in the yard and throws $20 bills in the front yard. I think one time he did come home, and, like, money had fallen out of her car, and there was cash in the front yard. But he thought that she was just, you know, because she would say, X dollars is not enough for the month. And he was like, yes, it is. But they just were not on the same page. He had no clue what it really cost to run a household with three kids, to get haircuts and birthday gifts and shoes and uniforms and pay for soccer dues. And I mean, he needed to understand what she was spending, and she needed to understand where he was coming from. You've got to have a budget and know and talk about it and know your money and what's going where. like I said, I heard Dave Ramsey, and that is his number one first thing he says before you can do anything else financially or start to build wealth or start to have freedom from this: budget. You have to have a budget. It does not have to be, you know, hourly like Alan Grafton's, but you have to start somewhere. You've got to talk about it together. All right, that's my little side note commercial. But it is biblical. Hosea 4:6 says, many people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Money's a huge topic. It's a huge part of our lives, whether we like it or not. And you've got to know about it. You don't have to be the expert in the money, but you've got to know your situation and know as a family, this is how we're going to handle this, and this is how we're going to view this, and have some knowledge about what's going on in your household. Just get on the same page. And then this is the benefit of it. A God-centered view of money and possessions leads to a quietness of heart that allows us to say, as Paul did in Philippians 4:10, I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or want. I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength. And I've been on both sides. I remember we had two little kids, and I came home from a doctor's appointment, and Alan said, well, I just got fired, and they'll be here in the morning to get the car and the computer. And I mean, we've been on that side. I mean, we were on unemployment for 6 months. And I remember saying, but even then we were careful with our money. We knew where it was going. We knew how to just monitor it and know. And I remember saying, you know, if you can do it for a little, you can do it for a lot. The same principles apply. And it just gives you so much freedom from that stress if you just know and understand what God has provided you, whether in plenty or in want, to find that contentment. And that is the greatest gift. It's not the amount. We shouldn't be striving for, I want X dollars. I mean, the prayer should be contentment so that we're happy wherever he's put us and whatever he's given us. The second view of seeking God is just realizing that he is our great reward. Hebrews 13:5, write this one down because this is such a great verse. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, for he has said, I will never leave or forsake you. If we have God and nothing else, if we lost everything else today, we have the only thing that matters and the only thing that can save us. Christ's blood is worth more than all the kingdoms and the riches in the world. So once we start to seek him, we should desire rightly instead of coveting. And again, we have to start with trying to remove from our life two coveting tendencies, and that's comparing and complaining. Just try to check yourself on that and guard against that. And it can be a habit that we do, but try to break that habit slowly over time. If you start to say something out loud or, you know, just stop yourself and think, no, look at what God has given me. I don't need to complain that I don't have what she has. Start to train yourself to limit that grumbling and complaining. But there are several truths in this area that I think with money that we have to embrace to really start to move away from coveting. First of all, embrace the truth that God knows your frame and he knows exactly what you need and what you can handle. When we talked about the first week on, you know, a good loving parent, if I said I'm going to give everybody at this table a peanut butter sandwich, but I know that one has a peanut allergy, that's not loving. And God is loving, and He knows us perfectly. So He's going to say, you get peanut butter, you get peanut butter, you get a grilled cheese. He knows us, and He knows that we can handle, some of us cannot handle wealth, or some of us cannot handle being poor. He doesn't want to give us too little. He doesn't want to give us too much. He knows exactly what we need. And He's the provider. There's such a confidence in that. He's not some parent in the sky doling out allowance that doesn't know His children. He knows exactly what we need and what we can handle. And these are just keys. Everything we have is because He gave it to us. We need to be so careful to not say, and we may say it, and we may hear it all the time, of like, but I've worked hard. This is my money. I mean, I've worked really hard for this money. It's mine. It's not. I mean, God gave you the ability to stand up and get out of bed and go to that job, and He gave you the talents and the skills to go earn that money, and in His providence, He gave you that employer and that job that He could take away tomorrow. It's His provision. It's not our hard-earned money. And we do work well to His glory, and we work hard for the things that we have, but we need to remember that He's providing those. Again, it's straight out of the Bible. Deuteronomy 8:17. Beware lest you say in your heart, my power and might of my hand have gotten this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is He who gives you power to get wealth. Katie said she had done a Bible study in the past that was titled, Wear Your Blessings Well. And I love that too, because I think we can sin on both sides. We can sin if we're wanting more and needing more and thinking we don't have enough. There can be sin there, but if you're wealthy, there can be sins there too of not wearing those blessings well. It is okay that you're blessed and you're wealthy. And like I said, most of us in this room are crazy wealthy compared to the rest of the world. And it's okay. I mean, lots of times in the Bible, God blesses people financially. And wear those blessings well and give God the glory for those and use them well and show them well to the community, because that will be salt and light, because it's not something that's done all the time. The next truth we've got to embrace is to desire to store up eternal treasures. I was in Atlanta this weekend with my youngest for her 10th birthday, and we stayed at a hotel for 2 days. I took a suitcase, like we normally do, but I did not go in and paint the walls. I did not take flowers to decorate the hotel. I did not rearrange the furniture or go in and think, yeah, I don't like that fabric. I need to redo that, because it probably was terrible. All hotel fabric's terrible, but I didn't do that. I mean, that would seem ludicrous, right? If I sent pictures of how I redid my hotel room where I was for 2 days, you would think I was crazy. We've got to keep that in mind. This is not our home. We are passing through this earth. We are just as temporary, probably more temporary in the big scheme of things on this earth, as to my 2 days in Atlanta. This is not our home. So why would we foolishly pour everything we have into fixing up this world or this? And I'm not knocking redoing couches or painting or whatever, but just that shouldn't be our focus, is to have the most we can have here and to be the most comfortable and to have the most beautiful and everything. It just, there has to be a balance. I say even a balance, not really a balance. It should be more skewed towards my eternal home where I'm going later. How do we do that? And of course we're going to spend money on things for this earth, and we're going to buy these things that we love and enjoy, and God wants us to do that, and He loves seeing His children delight in His provision. But we don't need to do that at the expense of storing up eternal treasures. And just question, I'm sure we could all do it. I was thinking this morning, we could walk around our houses, our closets, or think, oh, I wish I had that money back. We had somebody here that spoke a month ago about a ministry where you can send $38 a month that changes a life for a child in Africa. I mean, feeds them, clothes them, medical, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I could once a month go in my closet and be like, yeah, I've worn that necklace 2 times from a circle. We're going to do it and we're going to spend, but we need to make sure we're storing up those eternal treasures too and investing our money in things that will last forever, whether it's, just investing in eternal things, whatever that looks like, kingdom work, sharing the gospel. You can give to Young Life. There's my plug. That is spreading. I should have put the postcards on the table. That is spreading the gospel to kids. You can give to your church. You can give to helping build a new building. There's my other plug. that will hopefully stand for hundreds of years preaching the gospel. So just make sure you're investing in eternal things too. Matthew 6:19, very familiar verse probably. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. I mean, if our focus is on heaven and that home and storing up treasures there, our heart will lean that way. And this is the final thing that's just so key to realize that, and it's really eye-opening, and I would venture to say it's foreign to some of us in the room. Like I said, when I did that class, it was eye-opening, but it's so freeing. This is so key. If you hear nothing else today, that's not true. There's a few things. But it is not ours. Everything we own, everything we have, it's His money. It's not ours anyway. And to me, that's so freeing. 1 Chronicles 29:11. Everything in the heavens and earth is yours, O Lord, and this is your kingdom. We adore you as being in control of everything. Riches and honor come from you alone. Your hand controls power and might. It is at your discretion that men are made great and given strength. Deuteronomy 10:14. Behold, to the Lord your God belong the earth and all that is in it. Psalm 24:1. The earth is the Lord's and all that it contains. Whether you're a Christian or not, or whether you believe this or not, it's the truth. That doesn't change it. Like if this is brown, it's brown. Whether you want to, if you say it's blue or whatever, it's still brown. Everything on this earth is the Lord's. It's not ours. So we are a steward for Him. We're not the owner. And again, that's freeing, and it also gives us a bit of a responsibility to take care of these things. A steward is someone that cares for something until the owner comes back. And we need to do that well. And avoid becoming possessed by our possessions. And it's easier to be thankful for what we've been given when we don't take credit for getting it, and we realize that it's just God letting us use this for a season. 1 Corinthians 4:2, moreover, it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. And again, you can go read lots of parables in John about this and being a good steward. Matthew 25:21 says, well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many. Enter to the joy of your master. And that was the end of a parable where the master had given them talents. And one was so faithful with what he was given. And he didn't always give the people in the parables the same amount of talents. But we're called to be faithful with what he's given us. And that should be our goal. I mean, wouldn't we love to get to heaven and hear those words? Well done, good and faithful servant. You know, you were faithful with what I gave you. Next is give generously. Instead of taking, we do need to be givers. As Christians, we are called to give back to the kingdom. You know, in Acts, it's 20, it says it's more blessed to give than receive. And we say that all the time. Yeah. But it's so true. I mean, we can't lessen the weight of those words. We are called to give. Biblically, it's very clear. We are called to give 10% of what we have back to the kingdom. God clearly says, it's all mine, I'm giving it to you, but I'm asking you, commanding you to put 10% back into the kingdom, and you use the 90. Now, God, it is specific. We are still required to be faithful and godly and careful with the 90. We're not to just do what we want with that, but we are called to give back to the church. I'm trying to skip ahead. But the key is it's a matter of the heart. You know, God knows our heart, and He knows why we're giving and from what emotions we're giving. And the key is, too, God doesn't really need the money. We need to view this as a blessing. I mean, if you stop and think about it, God truly, you might be thinking, no, we got to turn the lights on in the church, and we have to have missionaries that can go to Africa and save. But He doesn't need our money to do it. It's a blessing and a privilege that He lets us participate in that. I mean, whatever my 10% comes out to be, do you think the God that created the universe and put the stars in the sky really needs that little amount of money to accomplish His purpose? No, but it's an invitation to be obedient to that and to participate in what He's doing. It's a blessing. And don't ever doubt that He is aware of it and He knows your heart and He sees what you're doing. I've had so many instances like this where it's just mind-blowing. when you give faithfully and you try to obey and you give from the right heart, that God sees that. I cannot make up this story. This happened, it was Christmas Eve a month ago. We had gotten behind on our tithing, and so we had to write a check, you know, for a few months. It was, I mean, more than I would drop coins in the offering plate. Anyway, we were supposed to write X dollars to finish our commitment that we had made to the church for that year. At the same time, we were, well, I'll tell you what it was. Alan wanted to go to the Sugar Bowl, and we needed X dollars to buy those tickets. That was a little painful, and I was like, oh. So I had this check that I needed to take to church, and I thought, I mean, I could just, like, I'm just gonna, like, I mean, I was kidding. I was like, we could just skim $1,000 off and buy those tickets, and we wouldn't even feel it. And, I mean, we've still given plenty. We were joking. I would not, I mean, in my good conscience, I could not ever do that. I'd made a commitment to the church of this many dollars that were going to the church. We joked, like, ha, we could just make that less. We didn't do it. Of course, we brought the check to the church. We're like, I mean, when it felt good because it was what we had called to do, we had committed to do it. I do not lie. I go home, open the mailbox. They had miscalculated my escrow account on my mortgage. X dollars right there. I'm not lying, y'all, within 2 hours. So don't doubt that God knows your heart and he knows and he rewards a cheerful giver. And I mean, I know we had joked about it, but I would never have, I mean, that was God's money. It wasn't mine to use. I was like, no, that's his 10. That's going, I kid you not, that check was on my counter 2 hours later when I came home. I mean, he knows and he delights in doing that. He delights in giving us blessings to be like, go enjoy the Sugar Bowl. I mean, he delights in that and he is aware of it. So do not ever doubt that. We are called to give sacrificially too. you know, Mark 12:42, a poor widow came in and put 2 small coins, which amount to 1 cent. And calling his disciples, Jesus said, this poor widow put in more than all the contributors to the treasury, for they gave from their surplus, but she gave out of her poverty. For in all she owned, she gave. And God knows the difference. Sometimes for us that have been given so much, we can just give a little bit and we don't feel it. But God does call us to give sacrificially. I'll never forget. And I say that 10%, he doesn't put a footnote that's the max you can give. Okay, he doesn't limit what you give. He delights in those that can give more. And sometimes he gives wealth so that he knows he's given it to godly people that can use it in amazing ways. I'll never forget hearing someone speak in Memphis years ago that was in business, and he had 3 children, and they just got to a certain lifestyle, and they said, we realized this is how much we need to live. We live on X. I remember he said it was like $120,000. I don't know what it was. He said, this is all we need. We have everything we need in a house. And da, da, da. He said, we committed that anything else we got over that, we would give away. And I know that's a huge number. I mean, don't get hung up on the number. I don't know what that is. But they just realized we could live on this. And anything we get over that, we don't need. And then God really blessed him financially. And he gave away half of what he was making. I mean, give sacrificially so that it's coming from your heart and you see why you're doing it. lastly, confess freely and to find that peace. This is something that we may need to talk about, and you need people around you to hold you accountable. Like I said, I do encourage you so strongly within a marriage. You've got to talk about this and share these concerns and issues and try to be on the same page. if this is a huge area of sin struggle for you, just bring it to the light. Like we talked about last week, just telling someone or talking to someone about it just sort of takes the power away from Satan in this area. Like I said, I heard Dave Ramsey give a talk in January, and it's like his top 6 things to wealth. The first one is budget. You have to know where your money's going. The second is debt. He's huge on debt. He wants no debt. His third, before he gets to saving and investing and giving away, the number 3 thing he says you have to do to find wealth, and when I say wealth, I mean almost just knowing your money and not being controlled by it, is surrounding yourself by the right Christian influential people. Meaning, if you struggle with trying to keep up with the Joneses, don't go be best friends with the Joneses. You know, you need peers around you that are like-minded, that understand giving, that wouldn't stand in your kitchen and say, are you crazy? Don't take that check to the church. Go to the Sugar Bowl and up your room. Or I mean, you need like-minded people around you that are peers financially, that are support your goals and your intentions, and that share that desire to save up for the kingdom, not just pull you in deeper. That does not mean you don't be friends with people of all different types of wealth and provision, and absolutely. But you need those godly people around you too that are going to hold you accountable if this is an area you struggle with. Again, I mean, he said that was next before saving. Just make sure that you've got other people around you saying these types of things that I'm saying, because these are foreign concepts to a lot of people out in this world that want to say, no, it's my money, I worked hard for it, or, you know, get all you can and save it up in this world. So like I said, in closing, I'm going to wrap up. The Bible is so full of verses on counsel and advice and warnings about coveting and greed. And I hope that this has just shed some light on those areas and given you a new peace and freedom about, you know, wanting what we don't have. And I do feel like the room is a little glum, like, oh, great, I'm such a greedy person. But I don't want to leave you that. I want there to be a peace about just in a freedom of realizing that God has given us exactly what we need and finding a peace in that provider. So to kind of hit this home, you know, sometimes you have to pull out the big theology books to make a point. So hope y'all can hang. So we talked about Eve, and now we're going to talk about another fellow coveter, Goldilocks. Okay. if you Google the story of Goldilocks, and the moral, it'll tell you it's about teaching kids to be responsible and not make messes in other people's houses. But I didn't see it that way. I think it's about coveting. So don't worry, I'm not reading this whole book. You're like, great, can't go to lunch now. Once upon a time, there were three bears that lived in a little stone cottage in the woods. I'm skimming. Big Papa Bear, middle-sized Mama Bear, and a wee little baby bear. One day, while the bears were still on their walk, a visitor arrived at their house. Her name was Goldilocks. She loved to pick blueberries and wander in the woods. That morning, she wandered from bush to bush, and before she knew it, she was standing in front of the cottage she had never seen before. She's seeing. She wondered who lived there and knocked on the door. When no one answered, she forgot her manners and walked right in. She smelled the porridge and rushed to the table. She was hungry. Okay, she saw what they had to eat, and she was curious. Was that better? She tasted the porridge. We know the story. It was too hot. Then it was too cold. Then she found one that was just right. Then she went in the other room. Ooh, look at their fancy chairs they have, she said. That's my interpretation. She saw the chair by the cozy fireplace. And you know, she sat in one. It was too big. It was too hard. It was too soft. This one was just right. But then she broke it. Then she wanders in. She sees their beds. Oh, don't those look wonderful and delightful? Ooh, I wish I had those in my house. She tries them all. This one's too hard. This one's too soft. This one's just right. So I will not go on the rest of the story. But I think we can learn from that. I think at the bottom line, she was coveting, right? She looked at someone's house, and she saw that they had something she didn't have, and she was curious, like, ooh, that might be better than what I have. That might fit better than what I have. That might feel better than what I have. That might give me more comfort or security than what I have. I think we do just that. But if you hear nothing else, but I do want you to leave with the peace and contentment that what you have today is exactly right. It is, as Goldilocks said, this one is just right. What you have today financially with your possessions where God has you, it is just right. And you may be thinking, no, it's not, Pamela, it's not. And I'm like, it is. And I'll tell you why I know it is. It's because it came from a perfect, loving Father who knows you exactly well, better than you can know yourself. And he knows exactly what you need and exactly what you can handle. And he is doing that and giving you that to complete his perfect plan in your life. It doesn't mean it's not going to change. It may go up. It may go down. It changes all the time. But today, you can walk out of here and say, today, it is just right. And tomorrow, you can wake up and say, it is just right. His provision is exactly what you need so that he can complete his perfect work in your life. So let's try to stop coveting. Let's stop looking over the fence. Let's stop looking for greener grass. Let's stop longing for and trying on what others have been given. Your wallet, your money, your savings, your house, your wardrobe, your income, your car, your clothes, they are not too big or too small. They are not too old or too new. They are not too many or too few. They are not too hard or too soft. They are not too large or too tiny. They are just right. I'm going to end in Psalms 73. Start at verse 2. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. Then at 16. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God. That's what we did. It's wearisome and it's daunting and we almost can slip until we come to the sanctuary of God. And then verse 25, and then we see, whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Let me pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this lesson. I thank you that you knew to give us so many verses on money and so much counsel and wisdom there because we need it, God. It's just something we're drawn to. And I just pray that you would challenge us, all of us, whether we are in a season of plenty or in a season of want, that you would just change our hearts because that's what matters. Not our bank accounts, not how much we give, not how much we spend, but our hearts that long for you and desire you and seek you. Just challenge us and change us this week. In Jesus' name, amen.